and asked her for her name and date of birth. She panicked for a second until she recollected that the birth dates were the same, even Miller's and hers. "Probably kids," the cop said. "Doesn't look too professional, the way they went through that wall. Must have raised a racket. Anything special they'd want with you?" She shook her head mutely, but his question unsettled her. "Probably kids," she told herself. She asked if she could look around to see what was missing. "TV's still there? Looks like most of the big stuff's in place. I must have scared them off. God knows what's in their pockets, though. You'll probably be finding stuff missing for days. But go ahead, look. Anything with some value could turn up in the North End. Be good to know about it." He walked through the apartment. The wreckage was upsetting. Every closet door was open. They'd gone through her bedroom with vicious speed, probably looking for jewelry. Her dresses were all off their hangers, and on most of the garments the pockets had been turned inside out. A small jewelry box on her bureau had been upended, the pieces strewn about the room. She'd never know what was missing, but it was all costume stuff anyway that the movers had provided. Even her bed had been disturbed. The spread and covers had been ripped off, and the mattress now sat crookedly on the box spring. A routine hiding place under the mattress, jokes notwithstanding. "Probably kids," she told herself again. When she went under, the movers had given her the option of keeping her FBI credentials. It was a rainy day measure, worse coming to worst. But if a snoopy boyfriend found them, well, most likely you were blown. That was how the leader, Dorval, had explained it. Agents who were undercover in the world of dope, of fencing, many of them held on to their creds because they were likely to get arrested. But she didn't figure to have that need, and she was relieved now she'd made the decision to leave them behind. Even her gun, much as she missed it, might have been a problem. She finally saw the logic. She went back to the living room. The drawers had been pulled out on a small desk there. She had been dictating today's 302 before she left, and she pawed around through what was on the floor, looking for her dictaphone. It was gone, as well as the spare microcassettes that had been in the drawer beside it. To her best memory, there was not that much yet on the recording. The case file number, her voice referring to herself as undersigned agent. Still, that cassette in the wrong hands would give her away. "Anything gone?" called the copper. "Hard to tell," she answered. There was so much disruption, so many odd things thrown here and there, that she knew the dictaphone and the tapes could still be here. She picked through clothing, books, CDs on the floor. She went into the bedroom and systematically worked her way around the room. In the living room, she found the dictaphone. But today's tape had been removed. Hoping, she checked her briefcase, but the microcassette was not in the side pouch where she routinely zipped the tape when she was done. 2 inches by one, though, the cassette would be easy to miss. It was going to turn up, she told herself. She walked around the apartment one more time, looking things over. Nothing else seemed to be missing. Then she realized that a birthday card she'd written to her mother, sealed in its white envelope and addressed, had also been removed from the desk. Fear darkly bloomed near her heart. She'd signed it Dee Dee. Still, that was nothing. Who'd make anything of Dee Dee? Only Marty Carmody, she realized. And Walter. As the anxiety began knifing deeper, she added it up. Would kids skip the CDs and go for a birthday card? Would they take the tapes and not the dictaphone? That's why the pockets of her clothing had been rummaged, why her bed had been overturned. Carmody's information had finally made the circle, from Walter to somebody who cared. The cop was ready to go. He stooped for his hat on her coffee table. As he did, the white corner of an envelope peeked up out of his rear pocket and even missed a breath. Lots of things came in envelopes, she told herself. Lots of people carried stuff in their back pockets. But she recollected all of Robbie's warnings about Brendan's enduring connections on the force. The brass, almost all of them, were Brendan's pals. He'd served on the force with most of the area commanders and had cultivated the others over the years. Malaki, in fact, was still on the job. "How'd this call come in, anyway?" Evan asked, trying to sound casual. The copper wiped a thick hand across his mouth. "One of the neighbors, I suspect." "You know which one? I really ought to go say thank you."
"Afraid not. Just a 911. Beat hell over here. You know how it is."
He was looking around the living room as if he'd left something. Maybe he didn't want to meet her eye. Or perhaps he was already wondering what tipped her. She'd gone back to the front window and looked through the mini-blinds down to the avenue. There was no squad car outside.
"It was just such a real surprise to find you in here," she said. "I didn't even see a police car outside."
The copper looked at her with sudden directness. His tiny eyes had hardened, and she cursed herself. She might as well have handed the guy a note that he'd been busted. And, like a bat suddenly flying through the room, Evan abruptly realized this man was weighing the thought of killing her. It was not necessarily something he wanted to do. It was just that he had never really considered his alternatives. But if she beeped the bureau for assistance, if they searched him and found that card and her dictaphone tapes in his pockets, his life was over. There was a chief's special, a .38 Smith & Wesson on his hip, and he could use any excuse. She snuck in. He mistook her for another bandit.
"You know the old trick," the cop finally said. "Come up on foot. I didn't want the perp to catch sight of a black and white."
He kept his pinkish face half averted, checking with one eye to see how this was being received.
"What kind of law enforcement you in?"
"Me?"
"You sort of sound like you know what you're doing with the fingerprints and all. Way you were crawling the wall there."
She noticed his nameplate over his shirt pocket for the first time. DeMonte. Then again, it might not even be his.
"I just watch a lot of TV."
She got a laugh with that, albeit somewhat obligatory. She desperately wanted to unheat this guy, put him at ease. Bad enough that they were on her, but even worse if they realized she knew. She went to her cupboard in the kitchen. It was open, too. The vodka was on the front of the shelf. Did she leave it there? Somebody trying to pick through her cover would be looking for liquor. She brought the bottle out with her, as well as a box of cookies, and offered DeMonte both.
"Not on the job, lady. I'm pretty much a beer guy anyway. Poor man's pleasures."
She made excuses about the bottle. Her boyfriend bought it. She didn't take alcohol herself, the way she was brought up.
"Methodist?" the cop asked.
No, Mormon. Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." He shook his head to show he'd never heard of them.
"Each to his own," he said.
He looked her over one more time, plainly still deliberating. Then, seeing no harm, reached over and took a cookie. He was gone a moment later. She thanked him lavishly, and he tipped his hat. She leaned against the apartment's painted steel door as soon as she'd closed it. That had been a bad minute there. Her knees were jumping around like fleas. Back in the kitchen, she found the crowbar still resting on the counter in the bag bearing the grocer's logo. But that made sense. Officer DeMonte had already found all the evidence he needed. Sennett did not want to believe it.
"A birthday card?" he asked.
"If I was a burglar, I might lift a birthday card. Maybe there's a 20 inside."
But Joe Amari had gotten agents from the Kendall County Division who worked regularly with the locals to tear this up. Over in Area 6, DeMonte had filed a report that said he'd responded to a burglary in progress, but Joe's guys had burned a copy of the 911 tapes, and a number of evidence techs had listened to all 12 tracks. There was no break and enter logged anywhere in DuSable between 8 p.m. and 10. McManus knew Sennett well enough to realize he'd have to hear this news directly. Heavy-set, but smooth, Joe sat calmly at the end of the table and delivered the report. Sennett began to speculate about why the call might not be recorded, and Amari lost patience.
Stan, nobody sends a single unit, let alone a one-man car, to answer a burglary in progress. You end up with officers down that way. And from what Even says, this critter had way enough wear on him to know better.
Amari, who was seldom reticent with his opinions, tucked his chin against his chest and gave Sennett the full measure of his solemn brown eyes.
Face it, Stan, these guys are on her. They've got the dictaphone tape, and they know that Carmody said he was fooling around with an FBI agent named Didi, and that's the name on that card.
The weak light of a rainy morning leaked into the conference room through the open blinds. Trying to take this in, Sennett popped his middle finger rhythmically against the small, dark O he made of his lips. Stan had his vision. He was going to round up every corrupt lawyer and judge in the Tri-Cities. He was going to use all of law enforcement's latest technological gadgets and put together a cinch case on every one of them. Dozens, maybe 100. He was going to drive them like a herd of branded cattle down Marshall Avenue, in the full sight of the world, clopping along with their heads down as they moved on towards Stan's personal slaughterhouse in the federal building. And at the head of this legion of disgrace would be Brendan Toohey, the guy everybody told Sennett he'd never get. And now he wouldn't. The bad guys were on alert. Finally, he turned to Even and asked her what she thought.
"I'd like to stay out there," she answered.
Across the table, McManus's smile was almost sweet.
"We know that, Even. We all do.
But the boss wants your opinion. You were there. Do you think you're burned?" She might have fooled around with Sennett, but she would never diss McManus. She believed in all the same true blue stuff he did.
"Cremated," she answered.
Even Sennett managed a smile. He got up and walked around the room for quite some time while he weighed the real question. What did they do now? Everyone else hung there in the usual suspense. The beeping and scraping of the traffic down on the avenue wandered up here. Suddenly, Sennett faced them with a vague smile and his head at the same inquisitive angle practiced by most mammals.
"What if we go with this?" he asked. "Assume they know she's FBI. We can't afford not to. But what says they realize what she's doing? Maybe Robbie's the guy under the microscope, the one she's investigating."
Sennett, hurtling with the momentum of his idea, was happy again. No one else seemed to see what pleased him.
"We can get a clean shot at Brendan this way. Robbie thinks he's got an FBI mole in his office, so he goes to Brendan for advice. What should I do? Knowing who she is, too, he can't afford not to warn Robbie."
Even had always felt grudging admiration for this part of Sennett. He was like a screw that kept turning, no matter how impregnable the surface it was supposed to penetrate. McManus took a minute.
"You want to do this while Even's still working in Robbie's office?"
"Why not?"
"These guys have too many ways, Stan. They showed us that last night."
"Even's a big girl," Even said. Sennett opened a palm in her direction. McManus, who'd heard the line before, made a face, then stole a look at Amari, who also shook his head no. Stan continued pitching.
"After all the work, all the months, they had to take a shot at Brendan. They had to.
And she had to remain in place to give Robbie credibility when he went to Toohey to ask about what he should do. The fact that she was still here would mean she and the Bureau didn't suspect who that copper Demonte had been fronting for, didn't realize she'd been uncovered."
"Stan," said McManus, "these boys don't lack for hormones. There's a real chance they'll make a move."
"All the better," Sennett answered brightly. At moments, it was shocking how little Stan cared whether or not people liked him. His logic was cold-blooded. If Robbie went to Brendan on Monday, and on Tuesday they found some punk snipping Even's brake lines, it would close the circle, make the case. Jim, the steady master of his emotions, was visibly shocked. His lips parted once or twice before he spoke.
I don't bait traps with agents. Not if I can avoid it. And neither does you, Cork.
Jim, I can handle this, she said.
His eyes came to her without the slightest movement of his head. She was out of place. He closed the file folder before him and said he needed some time with Stan. Even and Amari quickly left together.
Big stuff, said Shirley from behind the Red Oak receptionist's station.
Even had taken a seat across from her. Plump and reliably cheerful, Shirley in her real life had been a state cop somewhere before joining the Bureau. Neither she nor the other UCAs knew exactly what had happened last night, but they all seemed to feel something was up. Klecker came through from the other side of the space.
¿Qué pasa?
He asked. Even shook her head as if she didn't know. McManus came out in another 10 minutes and pointed her to his office. The movers had decorated with a minimal concession to his tastes. There were photos of the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia on the paneled walls. The supposed mementos of a lifetime were displayed on the office's open shelves. He had a bronze letter of achievement from the chairman of Moreland Insurance in a brass frame and a pewter triple block from his bygone sailing days. There was also a signed photograph of Mike Schmidt taken at the vet in Philly, inscribed to Jim. The autograph was a phony, but McManus had confessed to Even that his family, the wife and the kids, were in the photo somewhere, probably, she supposed, in the stadium's seats. The only other thing Even knew about Jim was that he had been an Eagle Scout.
Literally.
And at least one of his sons was as well. He'd said something about that at a party. He sat, then thought better of something, and got up to shut the blinds. From now on, they were going to assume that Tui had a full counter-surveillance going. Jim leaned against his desk on her side. She knew before he started that he was pulling her in, and she began talking him out of it before he could find his words.
Jim, I know what I'm doing.
It's not your choice.
You can put the whole surveillance squad on me.
Dee Dee. He hadn't called her that since the day he'd met her in Des Moines. We had surveillance on you, and this creep walked right past them. We're lucky he didn't kill you. The next time they catch hold of you, it'll be guys in ski masks, thumping you all night long to find out what we've got.
Then make sure I've got company. 24 hours. Have Shirley move in with me. And I can pack again now.
I'll be safe. Jim, I know what I'm doing.
No, you don't, McManus said. But he was smiling gently again, much as before, with admiration. At moments, she was amazed to realize how much he liked her. He'd liked her from the beginning. She begged. He had 1,000 more objections about U-Cork and the feasibility of Senate's plan, but she could see he was wearing down.
Jim, we all deserve a shot at Tui. I do. You do. Senate does. We can't stop here.
She was almost desperate with that thought.
How could she just go back to Des Moines, to bank thefts and church choir and thinking about getting a new cat? I mean, Jim, she said, and spoke one of her errant pieces of humor, a joke that was not really a joke at all. I'm Even Miller.
June. Chapter 33. In the grainy reduction of the black-and-white monitor on which we watched, His Honor Brendan Tui, presiding judge of the Kendall County Superior Court's Common Law Claims Division, was mustached with confectioner's sugar when he first came into view. The picture had careened as Robbie had entered the restaurant, tossing off morning greetings with characteristic brio to the owner and several members of the staff. When favor had reached Tui's table, he had apparently set his briefcase and the camera within it on an extra chair, or perhaps on the next table. Whatever the perch, it afforded a well-framed picture of the three men he was joining. Paddywax was another venerable Kendall County institution. Its appeal was not in the overripe decor, brass fixtures and tufted benches and floors that were mopped once a week.
Rather, it was renowned for its gargantuan omelets and its early morning clientele, which included most of the county's important insiders, office holders, party bigwigs, and the ward types and others who relished the opportunity to mingle with them. While Augie Bolcaro was living, he had appeared here at least once a week, and Toots Nuccio, the octogenarian fixer, had a large table in the corner where he kept court every day with his many vassals in politics and the mob. In the world of the Democratic Farmers and Union Party, where working-class values still forbade too much overt splash, one of the truest signs of stature was if the gregarious proprietor, Plato, released the red velvet rope with which he restrained the regular trade and beckoned you to a table at once upon your arrival. From the surveillance van parked immediately across the avenue from Paddywhack's plate-glass doors, Sennett and McManus and I, like Macbeth's witches around their cauldron, watched the black-and-white imagery froth up on the monitor. The guessing game concerning what Toohey's cohort knew about Even left everyone uncertain about how they would react to Robbie. He might encounter anything, a beating, the cold shoulder, or some preconceived drama intended to portray their innocence. Amari and several local agents were circulating through the moderate early traffic on radio silence, but tuned in for emergency direction. Depending on the turns in the conversation, Stan was prepared to respond with surveillance, or even, in his fantasy, a bust. I had gone to see Robbie on Friday to tell him what would be required today. We sat in the perfect white living room which had been restored to order for the days of visitation following his mother's death. Robbie remained gripped by that retrospective mood, and, with little prompting, his conversation wandered to his childhood memories of Toohey, which remained intense. Hungry for men, for their smell, their ways, their company and example, Robbie loved Morty's uncle more, frankly, than Mort seemed to. He was allowed to address him as Uncle Brendan, and despite the fact that Sunday was Robbie's only full day with his mother, he rarely missed one of the afternoon suppers when Toohey appeared at his sister's table. Brendan was still a cop then. With his gun and his blue patrol uniform, Brendan seemed as aurored and heroic to Robbie as Roy Rogers, and he was greeted with roisterous delight by the boys when he arrived in the entry of the Dinnersteins' home. After supper, he'd let Mort and Robbie gallop around the house wearing his heavy cap with its strip of silver braid along the short brim. Occasionally, he would even unsnap the polished black holster on his hip. He'd empty his service revolver and allow the boys to hold the weapon and inspect the brass-jacketed dum-dum rounds, which he stood on end on the dining table, a lethal hollow cut dark and deep into the leaden tip of each bullet. "Even then," Robbie told me, "I was scared of Brendan. You had to be. There was this thing that came off of him, like a smell. You knew he didn't completely like anybody, that he was pretending just a little bit with everyone, except his sister." The stories he liked to tell were of his rough encounters on the street, shellacking some mouthy blackguard he'd caught up with in a gangway. Sometimes on Sundays, Estelle also came next door with Robbie for supper. For a period, he said, she actually seemed to have taken some kind of shine to Brendan, and Robbie could even recall a cockeyed childhood hope that Brendan would become his stepfather. But Estelle was a decade older and not really of interest to Brendan, and Robbie's mom, for her part, would have no more considered marriage to a Gentile than to an ape. She always came home talking about how much Toohey and Sheila drank, expressing a kind of sorrowing wonder that Mort's dad, Arthur Dinnerstein, could put up with it. For Robbie, starstruck by Brendan, these criticisms were incomprehensible. Eventually, Estelle stopped accompanying her son. Brendan passed the bar, joined the prosecuting attorney's office, and appeared on Sunday in the suit he'd worn to church, rather than his police regalia. "It was all downhill," Robbie told me. "Something came apart." He wasn't specific, but his eyes froze in the past, pinched for the shortest moment by obvious regret.
Then they swung back to me with a lingering dark look.
So, what do you think, George? Is it just silly chatter when I talk about Brendan having me waxed?
I didn't think it was silly.
There were certain practical incentives. If Robbie's car blew up, if he were run down by a speeding auto, if his remains were found tangled in the limestone crags along the river, Tui's cause would be immeasurably advanced, not so much because Robbie would no longer be available as a witness, but because anybody else with thoughts of flipping would be bound to think several times. But in 25 years in practice, I'd had only a single client who'd found turning fatal. John Collegio was an oil executive who'd played ball with the wise guys as a young man, and then, after he'd risen up the phylum, went to the G to complain about the way gasoline was distributed, the mobbed-up companies getting the first supply. He'd been killed with a shotgun blast when he answered his front doorbell at dinner time. But within the outfit, that would have gone down under the rubric of internal affairs. They seldom took aim at civilians. All in all, killing a federal witness was recognized as a very poor idea. The FBI did not take it lightly. As a threat to the entire process, it ranked just below killing an agent, or a prosecutor, or a judge. For that reason, it would bring down heat that would make the effort poured into Petros look restrained. The truth was that if Robbie was going to have a problem, the most likely time was afterwards, in prison. He'd go to one of the federal prison camps, Sandstone or Oxford or Eglin in Florida, where the inmates played golf and tennis after work. In the old days, before Reagan and Bush had federalized street crimes, that was not really a concern for someone like Robbie. The worst damage another inmate was likely to inflict was to take you badly at cards. But these days there were plenty of thugs in the federal prison camps, dopers who were inside for clean offenses like money laundering, the only crime the government could prove. Wounded, braggart, futureless boys, they had killed before and gotten away with it, and would do it again for a lark and the right price. Robbie would have to do his time in segregation, and even at that, watch his back. But I had always regarded as remote the chance that Brendan would actually orchestrate something on the street now. Robbie stared out the window toward his neighbor's vast homes and smooth lawns, trying on my assurance for size.
No matter how you slice it, the best thing for me is to bag him, right? Go in and get him. The whole thing topples.
He had thought this through clearly. Robbie would be safest the day Brendan was indicted and pried away from the levers of power. Accordingly, Robbie'd had an air of resolve when we'd met today at 5 a.m. to go over the scenario. Then he'd walked by himself to Paddywax, while we took up our station across the street. He held his shin-length Italian raincoat of a fashionable muddy shade closed at the collar, although the day was not particularly brisk. Brendan had been easy to find. His morning rituals were unvarying. At 5 a.m. he attended Mass across the way at St. Mary's Cathedral, one of the few men among the elderly female devotees. Then he joined Rollo Kosick and Sig Malachi here at Paddywax, where Plato customarily opened the doors for them long before the usual gala breakfast crowd had assembled. The three sat at a small round table near the windows, where Brendan, the master of public relations, could throw off a hail salute to the many important citizens approaching the front door. When I turned on my seat in the van, I could see them clearly through the pale whorls of the one-way bubble window. Malachi chattered. Brendan showed occasional signs of amusement, while Kosick finished his breakfast first, then stared at his cigarette as it burned. With Robbie's arrival, Tui smiled faintly at the mess he had made of himself, surrendering the Bismarck, still swollen with dark jam, to the plate in front of him. Then he tidied himself carefully with his napkin before extending a hand to Robbie. Kosick and Malachi offered greetings, and Malachi drew his chair aside to allow Robbie to join them. Instead, mindful of the camera, Robbie moved to the opposite corner. It was a few minutes before 6, and in the background two waitresses in their white uniforms stood in the corner of the smoking section, a few feet behind Tui's table, gabbing before the morning crush. It was the Tuesday morning following Memorial Day, and despite occasional ringing china and shouts from the kitchen, the restaurant on the Foxbite transmission seemed sweetly still as the world slowly shook off the slackened tempo of the holiday.
"We were just raising good thoughts about poor Wally," Tui said.
Robbie didn't understand.
"Wunch," said Milwaukee. "You didn't hear? The big C."
Walter, it developed, had been diagnosed last week with pancreatic cancer. In the van, Sennett moaned when he heard the news. It was hard to turn a man who had no hope of living.
"Doc gives him 6 months with the chemo and shit," said Milwaukee. "Wally says his wife's already marking off the days on the calendar. Have to hand it to him. Same brick. Guy always looks unhappy, and this didn't make it any worse."
The thoughts of mortality turned the conversation to Robbie's mother. Tui and Kosick had appeared briefly at Robbie's home the week before last to pay their respects. It was a predictable gesture from Tui, who favored ceremonial occasions, but Robbie now unctuously expressed his appreciation.
"Not at all, Robbie. Lit a candle for Mom this morning. Lord's truth, Estelle was a grand lady. I've been thinking about both of you, son."
In the image on the monitor, like a sight seen through a rain-streaked glass, Brendan daintily lifted his hand in Robbie's direction and took the occasion to dispense further advice. Along with Mort's mother, Tui had been born in Ireland, emigrating by the time he was 5. On occasion when he spoke, you could still hear the piping echoes of a brogue.
"You're in a tough patch now, Robbie. We know that. With Mom and Rainey in such a difficult way. You have to keep your faith, though. I can still remember the day I lost my Mame like it was yesterday. The best consolation is prayer."
With a long, gnarly finger, Brendan pointed his way. Milwaukee, voluble in his appreciation of Brendan's many pieties, uttered, "Amen." Robbie, in the meantime, saw his opening.
"Shit, Judge. I'm praying, but not how you mean."
His chair scraped the floor as he came closer and hunkered over the table. Like a bungled tape delay, the image ran some milliseconds ahead of Robbie's bare whisper as he told them about Even. Sennett had wanted Favor to try to get Tui alone, but Robbie said Brendan would be far more relaxed in the secure presence of his henchman. Leaning in, Robbie had cut off a bit of the camera's angle, and I turned back to the bubble where I found the sight through the front window of 4 heads gathered in such plain conspiracy, almost amusing. Life, generally so subtle in its textures, is disarmingly blatant now and then. Barely a foot separated the crowns. Brendan's tidy gray head, Milwaukee's greasy do, Rollo even now touching his thinning hair to keep it in place, each trained on Robbie as the story grew more dire. He described what Walter had said about Carmody. The girl had laughed it off, and he had consequently dismissed it. But it ate at him, Robbie said, and the following week, treating it as a dare, he'd asked her to let his secretary look her over in the John for a wire. She'd refused, then agreed the next day when the secretary predictably found nothing. But the paralegal was getting buggy. She'd been burglarized last week and came to the office on Friday positively frantic. She'd spent nearly an hour searching her cubicle, asking her co-workers if they'd seen some dictaphone tapes. The problem, Favor said, was that no one in the office had ever used a dictaphone. Their system required different cassettes. What was she doing with her own tape recorder?
"I mean, Jesus, do FBI agents look like that?" he asked. "Hell, this babe was crawling around in the sack with me."
"That means she's G for sure," Milwaukee whispered.
Everyone at the table laughed, even Kosick. It had sounded like a joke at Robbie's expense, particularly considering the source.
A robust, big-bellied man, a plain-clothes copper from Central Casting, Milaki always had a good time. He wore an old-fashioned hairdo with slicked-back sides in which the comb tracks were grooved precisely in the Vaseline. Milaki had been Brendan's partner during his brief time on the street. Tui had not remained a patrol officer for very long, but like all old soldiers, he maintained a permanent nostalgia for his period of fortitude and courage, and he carried Milaki with him as an enduring emblem. At this point, Robbie had said, he felt he had heard an account of virtually every day they'd had riding in Squad 4221. During Tui's years in the felony division, Milaki had been detailed by the force to run the warrant office, losing the arrest warrants that Brendan wanted destroyed, usually for the benefit of his mobbed-up pals. In one of those mysterious arrangements that no one outside the police force could ever be made to understand, when Tui had moved to common law claims, Milaki had gone with him. He remained a cop so he could qualify for his pension, but he was now assigned directly to the presiding judge's chambers as the police liaison to the sheriff's deputies in the courthouse. In reality, he did Brendan's bidding, everything from squiring him about in a black Buick owned by the force to fielding calls like the ones Robbie made from time to time aimed at denoting certain cases as specials. Milaki now insisted he wasn't kidding. He claimed to have heard lots of tales. It was a favored stunt of feds undercover, especially the females, to sleep with the suspects in order to establish themselves. Of course, they denied it on the stand. It was like the coppers who posed as Johns and said they'd announced their office before the blow job instead of after. The four men laughed about that as well. Robbie, in time, asked again what he should do.
"Fire her," said Milaki.
Both Tui and Kosick sat stonily, as though Milaki hadn't made the remark. Looking at the tape later, I had the strong impression that Milaki knew less about Ivan than the other two. Robbie, as always, held to his role and doughishly turned to Tui to confirm Milaki's advice.
"If you have an employee you don't trust, it's probably sensible to consider firing her."
The mildest shrug elevated Brendan's slender shoulders. The thought was hardly revolutionary.
"But does it look like I'm guilty if I fire her? I mean, she knows I'm Hinky because I talked to her after Walter. I mean, I keep wondering, is there something I can do to throw her off the track?"
Tui was long and narrow, with a thin but agreeable face. With Robbie's last remark, he retreated somewhat. The tidy gray head came up, and on the monitor you could see him appraising favor.
"These are questions, Robbie, I think you'd best ask yourself."
"Well, I thought you'd be concerned."
"Do I look concerned? A man shouldn't wear his troubles on his sleeve, Robbie."
"Well, Judge, you and I have never talked about things,
and we shouldn't be starting now."
Tui took a measure and popped out a short, exasperated laugh.
"Robbie, you're past the age where I can be looking after the two of you every moment. I can't call the precinct house the way I did when you and Morton were 14 and nicking lewd magazines."
"Well, this isn't about naked ladies, Brendan. You know that."
"I do. No such thing. How would I know that, Robbie? I don't keep track of your doings. I can't. You appear in my court. You understand how I must behave. If you've done something that skeers you..."
"Skeers you."
"Then I'm sorry, Robbie, but I'm a judge, not a father confessor. You start telling me your sins, I've got no choice but to turn you in. And Lord knows neither of us would care to see that."
Tui sat straight in his chair now, delivering his brief monologue with appropriate gravity.
"He's hosing him,"
Sennett said with anguish behind me. But it was a better performance than mere denial. Brendan was a master, the kind of man who did not say good morning to you with only one thing in mind. Ulterior purpose clung to every remark as if it had been greased, and he was actually letting Robbie down easy with this speech, explaining his position.
He's got to go for it, Sennett demanded. Right now. Lay it right there. Come on, Robbie. What do you mean you don't know what I'm doing?
But it did Stan as much good to coach the screen as any armchair fan. When Robbie repeated Tui's first name, the judge refused him with a stern rattle of his narrow face. He would hear no more. Malachi and Kosick, who had hung back, certain Tui would know best, now inserted themselves. Malachi actually raised a tempering finger in Robbie's direction. In the silence, Brendan Tui looked down and brushed some more of the confectioner's sugar from the lapels of his straight-laced suit.
"Robbie, it sounds to me like you should get yourself an attorney," he said. "Get an experienced federal man. You might want his advice."
"What am I going to tell an attorney, Brendan? What do you want me to say to him?"
Sennett had anticipated Tui and had fed Robbie that line, word for word. But Brendan was nimble.
"Tell him what you like, Robbie. Tell him what he needs to know."
"Jesus Christ, Brendan, don't you understand? She's seen a lot of stuff."
A brief, derisive sound ripped not from Tui but from Kosick. Rollo gave Robbie a deprecating glance through one eye and took the trouble now to stub out a cigarette. There was no further response out of any of them.
"Judge, you don't get it. It's not me I'm really worried about, it's Mort. Somebody looking at things could get ideas about him."
Mentioning Mort had not been part of the script. It invited considerable difficulties if Tui decided to talk to his nephew. But like most of Robbie's vamping, it was clever and effective. The presiding judge was finally caught short.
"Morton?" he asked.
"You know him, Captain Oblivious. There were a couple of things. I mean, I don't even want to talk to him about this shit. I haven't said a word yet."
"A good thought, Robbie."
"But, Judge, there was a thing with Sherm—"
"No,"
said Tui suddenly. The rebuke, though not above a whisper, was delivered in the severe tone of a schoolmarm.
"No, Robbie. I can't be hearing this. You have to talk to your attorney. That's how this must proceed. Have you someone in mind?"
"Well, Jesus, no. I mean, I wanted to talk to you."
"Give it some thought, Robbie. This deserves careful thought."
With Tui's full attention upon him, Robbie spun through a series of baffled gestures. Finally, as if it was almost plucked from the air, Favor mentioned my name as a neighbor in the Le Sueur building and an attorney who referred cases to their office. Tui lowered his face a bit, almost to the line of the camera, as he dutifully reflected.
"Wonderful lawyer. Saw quite a bit of him when he was bar president a few years ago."
McManus, beside me, had taken in the unfolding scene with his customary mute resolve. He'd leaned toward the monitor motionlessly, except as things grew particularly tense when he allowed himself to circle his thumbs. But now he looked over his shoulder, giving altitude to one eyebrow and displaying the lump his tongue made in his cheek, so that I actually felt a bit sheepish. Tui's claim of close association with me was mostly blarney. I'd seen him twice in connection with an initiative he'd suggested on mediation. Visiting Brendan's capacious chambers in the temple, I always found myself thinking about the term apartments, as in papal or royal. So many little rooms, so many county employees of such brisk cheer nearby, all of them with unfaltering reverence for the man they referred to as the presiding. The outer offices were thick with relics of his rule, photos of Tui and various somebodies, gavels and plaques and framed mementos. The inner chamber, though, where Tui worked, was spare, the bookcase decorated only with a scale of justice and a realistic portrait of Jesus laying on hands. Given his cultivated political sense, Tui knew that to favor one, anyone, was to exclude others.
"Very careful. Lawyer's lawyer," Brendan now said of me. "But in these circumstances,"
Brendan gripped his chin thoughtfully before delivering the judgment he'd intended to render all along,
I don't really think he's the choice I would make.
Really?
Leaning on an elbow, Robbie looked up at Brendan obediently.
Stan Sennett's best man.
From Favor's minute jolt, I suspected I'd glossed over this detail. I was amazed at the nuggets Tui had laid away.
Second marriage, he stood up for him, if I'm not mistaken. Very touchy, because that's the kind of thing that could be helpful, you know. But overall, I'd say too close for comfort.
McManus let his eye roam toward me with one more sidewise ironic twinkle. But I felt lanced by Tui's observation. Too close for comfort, I thought. I was entirely powerless to look at Stan, although I doubted he would focus for the present on much beside the artful manner in which Tui was dancing further and further away.
Suit yourself, of course, said Tui. You can never tell. But were I you, I'd be more inclined to someone who's known to give the government no quarter. Do you know Mel Tooley at all? Solid as an oak, Mel. Ask around about him. I suspect you'll like what you hear.
Mel, in fact, was famous for never flipping a client.
If you talk to Mel, he might even want to come by to see me.
With that, Brendan allowed the chromed legs of his chair to ring as he pushed away from the table. The meeting was over. Tui sat erect and proud. He knew he'd handled himself with customary deftness, tiptoeing down the chalk lines with the delicacy of Nijinsky. From his feet, with Malaki and Kosik beside him, Brendan laid his dry hand on Robbie's coat collar and delivered one more perfect line.
I don't feel concerned, Robbie, not a bit. You're the kind of fellow who can stay the course in hard times.
Tui reaffirmed that supposed compliment with a solid nod and turned, his two retainers on his heels. Across from me, Sennett began groaning again as soon as Tui started moving away. Stan ran his hands over his hair. He rarely allowed emotions to affect his grooming.
Ah! What a weenie performance! He should have gone for it! He had him!
I started to defend my client, but McManus uncharacteristically interrupted. Jim had given his usual dry eye to Stan's outburst. He allowed his tousled head a single shake. Stan, I don't think he was ever close. These guys are in no man's land. They know about Even, but they're not sure about Robbie. They don't want to cut him loose and give him a reason to turn on them, but they're going to be way careful. The van had left the curb. Another undercover agent, Tex Clevenger, a lean six-footer in his late 20s who posed as McManus's messenger, was at the wheel today, so Joe could run his cruise from the street. Tex asked if there were instructions for Amari, but Stan, still dying 1,000 deaths, ignored him. There's a way, he told Jim. He raised a fist, the knuckles white.
There is a way.
Chapter 34. They did not come for her. Not that Even expected it. She never felt in danger. Shirley and she drove to the office each morning with a cordon of surveillance cars whipping past them. Within a week, both of them knew all the OGVs, official government vehicles, or cars, as human beings put it. While Even was at work, a local agent was sitting in the dark in her apartment, using a flashlight to read magazines. Nothing happened. McManus finally let her have a gun. There was no point in sitting there unarmed while she was waiting for the boogeyman. The only weapon he could get her on short notice was one of the S&W 10mm that nobody in his right mind really wanted. Typical DC, good idea gone wrong. After the death of 3 agents in a shootout in Miami, the thinking types wanted 11-inch penetration, lighter ammo, fast expansion. Smith & Wesson made the gun to spec, but the thing was the size of a cannon. She'd need a beach bag, not a purse, to hide it. And the handle was bad. At home, she had an S&W 5904, high-capacity double-action automatic 9mm. That was a weapon. At McManus's urging, she'd spent the Memorial Day weekend following the break-in in Des Moines. She'd wanted to go to Denver to see her sister, but Merrill and Roy and the kids were at their new condo in Vail, fly fishing, and given the difficulty of booking flights over the holiday weekend, even would not have gotten there for much more than 24 hours. Instead, she turned the key on the life of D.D. Kurzweil. The house she rented was dark and had a close, unpleasant odor. The mice, she suspected, had had a field day, but the smell was more like what you'd expect in the home of an elderly person locked up with a dog. She made some calls and went to a barbecue with Sal Harney, another agent, who'd used her car while she was gone. Before he drove her home, she made him open up the safe at the resident agency office, and she removed her 5904. Sunday after church, she went to a civilian range and shot for an hour. The proprietor and a couple of his greasy-looking flunkies were watching by the time she was done. She kept the pistol in her purse now, storing it at McManus's when she ran over to the temple with various filings she was doing for Mort. Matronly, good-humored, Shirley slept on the sofa. At night, she talked to Even about her kids and drank a little too much. Shirley wore a white terry-cloth robe that wrapped around her, tight as the dressing on a wound, with long, hairy fibers dancing down from each sleeve. She had three children, two married. The last, a girl, a junior in college, was thinking about the Secret Service. Robbie was seldom in the office now. The excuse, imagined only a month before, that Rainey's decline would require his full attention, had, like some ill-omened wish, come true. Alf felt there was no way to ensure secure conversations over the phone equipment in Favor's home, and so twice a day, in the guise of transporting work from the office, Even appeared there to ferry messages back and forth from McManus. Robbie's capacities for buoyant denial seemed to have failed him entirely in the wake of his mother's death. Often, when Even arrived, she was startled to see that he had not bothered to shave. He explained himself succinctly one morning.
"No matter how much you tell yourself you know what's coming," he said, "you don't."
Once a day, Even went upstairs to greet Rainey. She was weakening quickly. The routine functions of life commanded all her energies. After a meal, she would sleep for at least an hour. Toileting, dressing, massage were exhausting, and as a result, she seldom had the energy to maintain her focus through much of a conversation, except with Robbie. The cuirass, which looked a great deal like a bowl-style vacuum cleaner, was fixed over her chest to aid her breathing in, but it tethered her to the bed. The equipment hissed away with an unnerving sound like a child sucking too hard through a straw. Worse, the doctor had said that Lorraine's carbon dioxide levels made it likely that within the next 2 weeks she would have to decide on ventilation. The alternative was descent into ALS's final phase, a slow, desperate suffocation. Robbie was sparing with the details, but his demeanor suggested he was losing in his effort to persuade Rainey to go on. On Tuesday, June 8th, I chaired the annual fundraising luncheon of the Kendall County Bar Foundation, an organization I'd started during my term as bar president. At moments, I wondered if I'd just wanted to leave a small monument to myself. So much of what is supposed to be charity has always been the refuge of ego. On the board, I was often wearied by the frequently politicized squabbles over which of many underfunded legal projects should be stinted. Yet I signed on every year. Doing less good than you'd want doesn't mean you're doing no good at all. For the event, judges and public officials were comped, as they say in the fundraising trade, and seated, one for each table, with paying guests, so we could peddle elbow rubbing and access in the name of charity. By this and other shameless devices, we had managed to gather nearly 500 people in the enormous grand ballroom of the Hotel Gresham. The room was an antique, a Gilded Age leftover. its gilt-ribbed pilasters and wedding-cake ceiling, leafed in gold, almost mocked the poverty of the people intended to benefit from the event, who were brought to mind only in the obligatory mid-meal video. Our keynote address this year came from Supreme Court Justice Manuel Escobedo, who was funny for 5 minutes before he sank like a weary traveler into the valley of his prepared text. Like most former courtroom lawyers, he was reluctant to leave the podium once he had returned there, and it was nearly 2 p.m. by the time the justice had finished. A dark-suited phalanx, eager to pound the phones and the word processors to pay for lunch, rushed between the majestic marble columns at the back of the ballroom even before the applause had died. Elsewhere, in smaller circles, some of the routine grip and grin that had gone on before the meal was briefly resumed, lawyers passing quick shots and greetings amid the gilt-armed fauteuil turned at all angles by the hasty departures. I hopped down the stairs of the rickety risers erected to form the dais and cast a parting wave to Cal Taft, this year's bar president, who mouthed a word of praise for a successful event. When I turned, Brendan Toohey was directly behind me in the space between tables. He was having a word with a couple of men I did not know, but his eyes crept my way once or twice, so I knew he'd noticed me.
"George!" he cried when he was free.
He grabbed my right hand and layered the left over it to add a special measure of sincerity. He said it was grand to see me.
"You fellows always do such a marvelous job with this affair, and it's such a fine thing for the bar. It's the Lord's work you folks are doing, George. It makes all of us proud."
I'm afraid my doubts may have reached my expression.
"No, no. Who was it who was talking about you, George, just the other day, as if you had wings coming out of your shoulder blades? Lawyer, I think, saying such nice things, I'd half a mind to blush on your behalf. Who was it?"
Toohey was a formerly handsome man with regular features. In age, a wizened, pinched look had enshrouded his light eyes, and whiskey or time had been harsh with his skin. There were large, rosy patches feathered with veins on his cheeks, and when he gestured, the backs of his hands resembled fallen leaves.
"Robbie Fever!"
Toohey shouted and gave his long, dry fingers an impressive snap that sent a shudder southward from my solar plexus.
"Robbie," I said.
"Yes, Robbie."
"Thinks you're a wonder, George."
I joked that I should probably ask for more than a third of the fee the next time I sent Fever a case.
"Hail fellow well met," Toohey allowed a moment of contained laughter.
Behind us, the busboys and waiters were already breaking the room down, snatching off the stiff linens to reveal the plywood circles with folding legs that lay beneath. There always seemed a fine irony in the disclosure that everyone had paid $100 a plate to dine on wormy lumber.
"Terrible burden that boy is carrying," Toohey advised me, growing somber. "Well, boy, now listen to me. But I've known him all his life. A grown man, many years, but that's how I think of him. Partners with my nephew. Did you know that? I take an avuncular interest. Concerned about him, naturally. I worry that all of it..."
Toohey folded his lips before resuming.
"He seemed a bit, I'd say, irregular when I bumped into him last Tuesday. Have you seen him since? Does he appear all right to you?"
I was no match for Brendan. I'd been bred to a reserve that, if nothing else, generally left me time to think. But I didn't have Toohey's speed or his guile. His probes, placed with the delicacy of acupuncture needles, could intrude barely noticed. What was coming to me through a process of plodding calculation was known to Toohey largely by instinct. But I finally realized he was at my side because he'd heard nothing from Mel Tooley. Mel was a former assistant United States attorney who had gone from being one of Stan's darlings to, more recently, a satanic outcast. Once he'd left the government, the appetites of private practice had led Mel to begin defending many of the same made members of the mafia he'd formerly investigated. There had been outrage in the U.S. Attorney's Office and protracted battles, which the government lost, aimed at throwing Mel off the cases. Stan had entertained thoughts of sending Robbie, attired in his sound-wired boots, to visit Mel, as Tui had suggested. Ucork, however, found there was no hard evidence of a potential crime and declined to authorize a recording. Stalemated, Senate had figured that silence might drive Tui or his minions to recontact Robbie on their own. Instead, Brendan had clearly concluded that, despite his discouragement, Robbie was seeking legal advice from me. Tui's glance swept over me like a searchlight. I did not know if it was my weakness or my honor that Brendan meant to exploit, but he was sure I would never mislead him, whether as a matter of high-minded rectitude or out of knee-knocking reluctance to offend the mighty. Appropriate lawyerly conduct was to let Brendan's lingering question pass with no comment, but I knew that, given his suspicions of me, he would feel he could no longer count on Robbie. And so in this grand old ballroom, with its velvet-backed chairs and huge mirrors veined in gold, I swung like a spider caught in descent on its own web. I should have moved off with the myth of the waiting conference call and let Stan clean up the resulting mess, but I stood my ground. I was driven by too many motives to know which was dominant. Commitment to my client was part of it. So was what Sennett, with his craft, had long counted on, namely, my anger and disdain over Brendan's private appropriation of the power of the law. Whatever, as I'd always suspected, I was thrilled to tempt the fates. Well knowing where the line lay that I'd long drawn for myself,